In recent weeks, Philip and I have been re-watching The Crown on Netflix, sort of as a way of numbing out a bit and avoiding present-day political reality. The alcohol is helping as well. I admit to finding many facets of the reign of Queen Elizabeth quite interesting, at least in this moderately fictionalized soap opera-ish format. There's something consoling about watching the intrigues of another nation's government that are at least as messed up as ours. But I'm also finding the narrative a bit depressing. For whatever good that came out from the British monarchy since the end of World War II, the dominant story seems to be one of white privilege and sexual infidelity. The royal family, or system, as they call themselves, certainly spent a great deal of time trying to clean up their own messes. Elizabeth, as a monarch, seems to try to stand above all that. Well, maybe not the privilege part so much. But her aloof demeanor, moral rigidity, and the limits of the contract of the constitutional monarchy seemed to have limited her while elected leaders sometimes ran amok with their political agendas. Apology to all Anglophiles out there. On this Sunday, we observe the last Sunday of the liturgical year as we await the beginning of another Advent season. In Roman and Anglo-Catholic circles, this is known as the Feast of Christ the King. Unfortunately, this is a designation which often creates more heat than light. To say the least, the idea of celebrating the kingship of Jesus seems only to reinforce all of the white supremacist, heteronormative tropes which go with images of power and privilege. Maybe if this were the Feast of Christ the Queen, it would be a slightly different story. The fact is, I doubt that the image of kingship appeals to many of us, though certainly it has a following of many who are hot to claim the kingship of Christ as a way of preserving domination of white Christianity over forces of secularization and religious diversity. In a piece written by queer theologian and pastor Allison Connolly Ventnor, the conventional implications of submitting to Christ's kingship are made clear. And I quote, "Preparing this essay, I came across too many homilies, prayers, and songs giving voice to conservative white Christians' fear of rising secularism and hostility against the church." End quote. In other words, this version of Christ's kingship seems to impose a narrow and oppressive type of Christianity, practiced only by some to keep the entire population of the nation in its place. She goes on to illustrate just one aspect of the agenda of the opposition to secularization, which is the alignment of some Christians with homophobic and transphobic institutions, quote, claiming that freedom of religion means that they are entitled to discriminate against LGBTQ plus people. She asked the question, how can I find meaning in celebrating a day used to justify Christian supremacy and even violence? Connolly finds a way out of this dilemma in part by citing the reflections of theologian, the Reverend Ellie Dowd, who reminds us that this Feast of Christ the King was only established 100 years ago, 1925, by Pope Pius XI, specifically in response to the rise of fascism in Europe following World War I and leading up to the Second World War. Dowd notes, at the time, authoritarian leaders of fascist regimes were being lifted up as all-powerful demigods. This sounds alarmingly familiar and current. As the expression goes, deja vu all over again. Of course, the irony is that the Pope, doing what popes do, was perhaps primarily interested in making the claim for the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church. But on a deeper level, this solemnity proclaims that fascism is diametrically opposed to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Down concludes, "The reign of Jesus Christ stands in strong opposition to the death-dealing policies of tyrants and fascists." All of this leads Connolly to declare the Feast of Christ the King as anti-fascist, requiring an orientation to a moral grounding in the authentic gospel of Jesus. In the Gospel of John, Jesus stands before Pilate as the one who is being rejected by his own people and who will ultimately be rejected by the political structure. Pilate's questions to him disclose that Pilate is also one who cannot hear the voice of Jesus. Yet Jesus does claim sovereignty, not of this world, but one which is only available to those who can hear the voice and recognize him as God's presence. We might do well to try and forget all the images we have acquired of Christ the King throughout our lives, all those portraits, those oil paintings, anything that sets him on a mighty throne surrounded by fire or angels or clouds or both, or ones where he is throwing spears and tossing sinners into hell. That's power. Those images are meant to capture one dimension of the Christ as the one of awesome majesty, equal with God in power and authority. But they do not capture what may be the most authentic essence of the Christ. To come closer to that essence, we need to picture Jesus in the desert, rejecting the entreaties of the evil one to claim his power and privilege. Or Jesus on the ground at Gethsemane, praying in fear of what was about to happen to him. Or picture Jesus dying dead on the cross. This submission to what appears to be failure is, in essence, the gateway to transcendence. But beyond these more isolated images, picture and hear Jesus preaching the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger for righteousness. Moreover, picture him with the woman at the well, or the man born blind, or the child raised from the dead. This is authentic sovereignty. This is what Christians know as the privilege of service and love of neighbor. Indeed, celebrating a feast in opposition to fascism seems like a very good idea right now. It is a reminder that we have always had to confront leaders and nations that go off the rails. Indeed, in the course of history, what goes around, in fact, does come around. It's not that the world has lost all sense of moral progress, moral righteousness. It's just that there's been a serious effort in such progress to give it a few dings. Still, this may not mitigate the sadness and outrage in the face of our own suffering, or even more importantly, the suffering of those who are most vulnerable. It is not enough to simply hold on to the idea that we may be right while all those other people are wrong. We need to let the suffering touch our hearts, only because this is the only way we break through the isolation of our own privilege and feel our common humanity with all who suffer. Ironically, that is what it means to fully participate in the presence of the reign of God, which may have more to do with surrendering to powerlessness than grasping at power. To say that recent political events feel like a setback feels like a massive understatement for so many of us, but perhaps it allows us to learn again how precarious justice can be, how complicated it is to live a very human existence, and how much we need to the strength and consolation of authentic leaders and role models. Throughout The Crown, Elizabeth struggles with feelings about a world which continues to evolve beyond her capacity to control or even completely understand it. She seems most comfortable when she's with her horses. I can see a certain understanding of that. She undoubtedly wondered about her ultimate effectiveness or whether she made a difference. She also seems to have recognized many of her mistakes and made the effort to change course from time to time. In the end, she stood strong in her commitment to what she believed. We might all aspire to the same grace.